Well, as promised, that was special music. It's very pretty. Thank you. Now, you probably didn't know this, but I have three arms. This arm, this arm. I'm talking about Eureka here. And there's a third arm sitting down there. Robin, we'll check it. Keeps after me to make sure that I address the things that I'm supposed to. And if she doesn't do it, then the fourth arm over there will take care of it for me. I forgot to mention the time change. And we're coming up to this time change tonight. How it affects services. Now, I have to confess, I don't like changing the time of when we meet. I don't like it. But I also don't want to break with tradition. For our good friends in the north, in the far north there. So yes, when I'm here, services will be at 12:30. When I'm not here, they may be at 12:30, they may be at 1:30. I need to talk to my right arm, and we'll make a decision together what works best for the congregation. All right? And if you have any special preferences, please let Robin or me know, and we'll take that into consideration. But for now, with the time change, when I'm here speaking here, it will be 12:30. All right? Okay. If you have questions, we can talk about that later. I've got a message here that I have thought about I was inspired by out of fear. I showed up the last time I was here. I came and I forgot to bring my notes with me. So that was a frightening prospect. Now, luckily, I happened to have a flash drive with me that had the notes on them. So I was able to get them printed off. But I began to think, what would I talk about if I showed up and I didn't have my notes? And I had been thinking about something, and it ended up being this message that I'm going to give you today. And I want to begin by reading a really obscure story in the book of Genesis. It's rather odd. It's chapter 38. And it's one that when you read it, you begin to wonder why this chapter is in the Bible. Just as a lot of odd things are talked about here. Chapter 38 and verse 1. It came to pass at that time, this is shortly after Joseph was sold as a slave. It came to pass at that time, Judah departed from his brothers and visited a certain Adullamite whose name was Hira. And Judah saw there a daughter of a certain Canaanite whose name was Shua. And he married her and went in to her. So she conceived and bore a son, and he called his name Ur. She conceived again and bore a son, and she called his name Onan. And she conceived yet again and bore a son, and called his name Shelah. He was in Chizib when she bore him. Now, this wasn't a visit. Okay. Said he went, he departed from his brothers and visited a certain Adullamite. No, when I visit someone, I'm not there for years. So it's an interesting phrasing that they have here. But let's pick up the story in verse 6. Then Judah took a wife for Ur, his firstborn, and her name was Tamar. Now, obviously, this is a long, long time. He goes there. He sees this woman. He marries her. He has children. Now this first one is old enough to have a wife. And so he gets a wife for his oldest son. But Judah's firstborn, was wicked in the sight of the Lord, and the Lord killed him. I mean, how often do you see something like that? There's no explanation other than he was wicked and God decided to take his life. And Judah said to Onan, go into your brother's wife and marry her and raise up an heir to your brother. Now that's an odd custom for us Westerners to come to grips with. No, but it wasn't something unusual in Judah's time. In fact, I want to read a little bit about that from one of the commentaries. It says this custom is called a Levirate marriage. It said the Levirate marriage, which is first mentioned here and is found in different forms among Indians, Persians, and other nations of Asia and Africa, was not founded upon a divine command, but upon an ancient tradition originated probably in Chaldea. It was not abolished, however, by the Mosaic law, but only so far restricted as not to allow it to interfere with the sanctity of marriage. And with this limitation, it was enjoined as a duty of affection to build up the brother's house and preserve his family and name. So how about that? A Levirate marriage. Okay, but what happens? But Onan, he knew that the heir would not be his. And it came to pass when he went into his brother's wife that he admitted on the ground lest he should give an heir to his brother. And the thing which he did displeased the Lord, therefore he killed him also. So now two sons are dead. And you think, well, what's the big deal? Well, the firstborn gets the double portion of the blessing, right? He knew it wasn't going to be his son. And it's hard to know exactly what was going on in Onan's mind, but again, this really displeased God. And this odd twist in the story, it's not really clear why it's so important. But, you know, the story isn't over. The story isn't over yet. Let's go to verse 11. Then Judah said to Tamar, his daughter-in-law, remain a widow in your father's house till my son Shelah is grown, for he said, lest he also die like his brothers. And Tamar went and dwelt in her father's house. So, with the promise that the line would be continued, they would wait until Shelah was older. Yet as time passed, it began to become clear that Judah was not intending to keep his promise. He really didn't want to do it. And maybe it was out of fear. Maybe he was afraid that Shelah also would die. We don't know. But Tamar gets the message that this isn't right. So verse 12, again, this isn't something that happened this week and then a month later this occurs. This is in a process of time. This could be years later. She realizes that Judah's not keeping his promise. So there's a lot of time that passes between verse 11 and verse 12. Verse 12, now in the process of time, the daughter of Shua, Judah's wife, died. And Judah was comforted and went to his sheep shearers at Timnah, he and his friend Hira, the Adullamite. And he was told to Tamar, saying, look, your father-in-law is going up to Timnah to shear his sheep. So she took off her widow's garments, she's plotting something here, covered herself with a veil and wrapped herself and sat in an open place which is on the way to Timnah. So she hears he's going to Timnah, she changes her look, her appearance, covers herself up, and is on the road that he's traveling down. For she saw that Shelah was grown and she was not given to him as a wife. That's why she was doing this. When Judah saw her, he thought, well, she must be a harlot because she had covered her face. Now that's Was that the custom at the time? I don't know. Apparently it was. Then he turned to her by the way and said, "Please let me come into you," for he did not know that she was his daughter-in-law. So she said, "What will you give me that you may come into me?" And he said, "I will send a young goat from the flock." So she said, "Will you give me a pledge till you send it?" Now I need something. I need a pledge. So he said, "What pledge shall I give you?" So she said, "Your signet and cord and your staff that is in your hand." Then he gave them to her and went into her, and she conceived by him. So she arose and went away and laid aside her veil and put on the garments of her widowhood. And Judah sent the young goat by the hand of his friend, the Adullamite, to receive his pledge from the woman's hand. But he did not find her. Then he asked the men at that place, saying, "Where is the harlot who was openly by the roadside?" They said, "Well, there's no harlot in this place. We don't know who you're talking about. There's no one here like that." So he goes back and he tells them. So he returned to Judah and said, "I cannot find her." Also, the men of the place said there was no harlot in this place. Then Judah said, "Let her take them to herself, lest we be shamed, for I sent this young goat and you have not found her." So I guess he thought, you know, it's better just to not to raise a ruckus here. We don't want the news spread abroad about this. Let's just leave it alone. No, I tried to pay her, and that's the end of it. So after this little dalliance, I'll call it, life returned pretty much to normal, at least for the next few months. Then we pick up the story again in verse 24. And it came to pass about 3 months after that Judah was told, saying, "Tamar, your daughter-in-law, has played the harlot. Furthermore, she is with child by harlotry." So Judah said, "Bring her out and let her be burned." So they were going to kill her. This great offense to the family. When she was brought out, she said to her father-in-law, saying, "By the man to whom these belong, I am with child." And she said, "Please determine whose these are, the signet and cord and staff." But Judah was basically a good guy. Let's see what he says here. Verse 26. So Judah acknowledged them and said, "She has been more righteous than I, because I did not give her to my son, Shelah, my son." And he never knew her again. Now, as I say, this is really an odd story. It kind of reads like a soap opera. But it's not the end of the story. It still isn't over. There's more. Verse 27. Now it came to pass at the time of forgiving birth that, behold, twins were in her womb. And so it was when she was giving birth that the one put out his hand. So he got twins. One sticks his hand out at the birthing time. What does the midwife do? Because she wants to identify the firstborn. That's really important. So she ties a scarlet thread around his hand. And she bound it on him, saying, "This one came out first." Then it happened, as he drew back his hand, that his brother came out unexpectedly. So he pulls his hand back. The other one's born first. She said, "How did you break through? This breach be upon you." Therefore his name was called Perez. Afterward his brother came out, who had the scarlet thread in his hand, and his name was called Zerah. Odd story. I mean, that's it. That's what you get. You read chapter 38, that's what you get. And you have to shake your head a little bit and think, what in the world was going on? Why this diversion? Over something, the odd details of the story, they're just odd. It's just very, very odd. But with that twist, that odd twist, you know, that's the end of the chapter. You know, and you, like I say, you wonder what it's all about. And it won't make sense, it doesn't make sense, unless you're able to connect up some other events that occur later, that are recorded in the Bible. And I'm going to begin to talk about some of those, but I'm going to start with a prophecy in Isaiah. Isaiah 9, verse 7. This is a prophecy that speaks of Christ's destiny as king. Isaiah 9, verse 7. Let me go down. Let's go to verse 6. For unto us a child is born, unto us a son is given, and the government will be upon his shoulder, and his name will be called Wonderful, Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, Prince of Peace. Of the increase of his government and peace there will be no end. Upon the throne of David and over his kingdom, to order it and establish it with judgment and justice, from that time forward, even forever. The zeal of the Lord of hosts will perform this. So you've got this prophecy about Jesus Christ. And it's interesting because it says he's going to sit on the throne of David. Right? Well, there were some pretty interesting promises made to King David as well. Let's look at a couple of these. And we'll start in 2 Samuel chapter 7. And we'll do verses 12 through 16. It says, when your days are fulfilled, God is talking to David, when your days are fulfilled and you rest with your fathers, I will set up your seed after you, who will come from your body, and I will establish his kingdom. He shall build a house for my name, and I will establish the throne of his kingdom forever. I will be his father, and he shall be my son. If he commits iniquity, I will chasten him with the rod of men and with the blows of the sons of men. But my mercy shall not depart from him as I took it from Saul, whom I removed from before you. Verse 16, and your house and your kingdom shall be established forever before you. Your throne shall be established forever. Let's read verse 17 as well. According to all these words and according to all this vision, so Nathan spoke to David. So God spoke to David through Nathan and gave him this incredible promise. Now over in Jeremiah 33, we also have something that is recorded that's connected with this. Jeremiah chapter 33 and verse 17. Jeremiah 33, verse 17. For thus says the Lord, David shall never lack a man to sit on the throne of the house of Israel, nor shall the priests of the Levites lack a man to offer burnt offerings before me, to kindle the grain offerings and to sacrifice continually. Like, let's read a bit more here as well. And the word of the Lord came to Jeremiah, saying, and thus says the Lord, if you can break my covenant with the day and my covenant with the night, so that there will not be a day and night in their season, then my covenant may also be broken with David my servant, so that he shall not have a son to reign on his throne, and with the Levites, the priests, my ministers, as the host of heaven cannot be numbered, nor the sand of the sea measured, so I will multiply the descendants of David, my servant, and the Levites who minister to me. Isn't that interesting? This is so certain, so sure that God says, my covenant with David, that he will always have an heir for the throne. How does he say it? He'll never like a man to sit on the throne. He says, that's like the covenant with the day and the night. If you can break that, then you can break my covenant with David. So that's how certain this is. This promise from God. An incredible promise. Yet, most Bible students and historians recognize there's a problem. There's a problem here. Where's the kingdom of Judah? Let's go to 2 Kings. Second Kings chapter 25. This is after the rebellion of Zedekiah against Babylon. And Babylon, King Nebuchadnezzar sends the army down to take care of it. Okay. Chapter 25, verse 7. Then they killed the sons of Zedekiah before his eyes. So he saw his sons killed. Put out the eyes of Zedekiah, bound him with bronze fetters, and took him to Babylon. He died in Babylon. So the nation of Judah was overthrown. All of Zedekiah's sons were killed. And he himself had his eyes put out and died in Babylon. So at least a couple of obvious questions. What happened to God's promise? What happens to his promises to King David? Where's the kingly heir? Where's the throne? Can you rely on God? Is really kind of the question that comes out of this. Now, did God fail to keep his promise? Can you trust him to keep his word? Now, if what happened to Zedekiah is where the story ends, then you'd have to have serious doubts about God and the promises that he makes. Now, his end would be very troubling to us. But, again, this is not the end of the story. Something else happens that's just mind-boggling. Let's go back to Jeremiah 39. Jeremiah 39, verse 11. Now Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, gave charge concerning Jeremiah to Nebuzaradan, the captain of the guard, saying, take him and look after him and do him no harm, but do to him just as he says to you. So Nebuzaradan, the captain of the guard, sent Nebuchadnezzar, Rabsaris, Nergal, Sharizner, Rabmag, and all the king's Babylon's chief officers. And then they sent someone to take Jeremiah from the court of the prison and committed him to Gedaliah, the son of Ahikam, the son of Shaphan, that he should take him home so he dwelt among the people. Now what in the world happened that Nebuchadnezzar tells the captain of the guard, well, there's this guy named Jeremiah. I want you to get him and take care of him. Don't do him any harm. I mean, obviously, God somehow got this message to Nebuchadnezzar. He gave this command, take care of this guy, Jeremiah. It's just stunning. Why would he do that? Well, I'm not going to read what happens in chapter 40, but there was an attack. A bunch of people were taken captive. Chapter 41, verse 10. Then Ishmael carried away captive all the rest of the people who were in Mizpah, the king's daughters, and all the people who remained in Mizpah, whom Nebuzaradan, the captain of the guard, had committed to Gedaliah, the son of Ahikam. And Ishmael, the son of Nethaniah, carried them away captive and departed to go over to the Ammonites. Let's jump over to chapter 43. We'll pick up the story in verse 5. But Jehonan, the son of Kareah, and all the captains of the forces took all the remnant of Judah who had returned to dwell in the land of Judah from all nations where they had been driven. Men, women, children, the king's daughters, and every person whom Nebuzaradan, the captain of the guard, had left with Gedaliah, the son of Ahikam, the son of Shaphan, and Jeremiah the prophet, and Baruch, the son of Neriah. This story gets really interesting, doesn't it? I think you can begin to see what's going on here. The king's daughters are still alive. They were not killed. Only the sons were killed. And what happens here is Jeremiah and the daughters are put together. They're together. They were taken captive together. They were rescued together. Now, the royal line of King David was going to be preserved through Zedekiah's daughters. That should be pretty evident. But how? I want to read an excerpt from an old booklet, old church booklet. A very early version of the United States and Britain in Prophecy. It says, Irish history has it that the Israelites arrived in Ireland before the time of King David. Throwing out that which is obviously legendary, we glean from various histories of Ireland the following. Long prior to 700 BC, a strong colony named Tuatha De Danann, the tribe of Dan, arrived in ships, they're saying 700 BC, drove out the other tribes, and settled there. Later, in the days of David, a colony of the line of Zerah arrived in Ireland from the Near East. Zerah, yes. Then in 569 BC, an elderly white-haired patriarch, sometimes referred to as a saint, came to Ireland. With him was the princess daughter of an eastern king and a companion named Simon Brock. The princess had a Hebrew name, Tephi, her full name being Tia Tephi. Now, of course, this is from a book that the church published. And I know that there would be those who would say, well, you know, how much credibility can you put in a book like that you guys published? Yet that the descendants of Zerah, that line, migrated to Ireland, and later married King Zedekiah's daughters. Now that finds some unexpected support in secular writings. And I have one right here. This one book in particular is very stunning. A friend showed me a copy of he bought several years ago. I went down, ran down and got a copy. It's called The Forgotten Monarchy of Scotland. The true story of the Royal House of Stuart and the hidden lineage of the kings and queens of Scots. This was authored by H.R.H. Prince Michael of Albany, head of the Royal House of Stuart. This is not a religious book. This is a book about lineage. That's what the whole book is about, is the lion. Okay? I want to read a few excerpts here. This is from page 12. On page 12. Scotland's royal heritage is the oldest in Europe and can be traced well back into the BC era. The legacy of the Scots kings was hewn on the Stone of Destiny. You remember the Stone of Destiny? The Stone of Scone? Jacob's Pillow? The venerated relic of the Bethel Covenant in Genesis 28. In about 586 BC, this stone, known as Jacob's Pillow, had been carried to Ireland from Judah during the reign of High King Eochaid of Tara. It became the sacred fealty stone of the Irish kings and eventually performed the same office in Scotland. Interesting. Let's jump over to page 30. In fact, I'm going to read a little bit more here than I normally would. The early Celtic Christianity was the oldest of all religious teachings to the original doctrines of Jesus. And it had immigrated, or it had emerged within a few years of the crucifixion as the foremost church of the Christian world. Christians of the Celtic Church were recorded in Ireland in the latter reign of Emperor Tiberius, that's AD 14, he was AD 14 through 37, long before St. Peter went to Rome. Well, he didn't go to Rome, but he thinks he did. Given that Jesus' own teachings formed the basis of faith, the Mosaic structure of the Old Testament was duly incorporated. Judaic marriage laws were observed together with celebrations of the Sabbath and Passover, while Easter was correctly held as a traditional feast day of the spring goddess Astarte. Long before the Roman Church foisted a new significance on the old Celtic festival at the Synod of Whitby in 664. Contrary to traditional belief, Emperor Constantine the Great did not embrace Christianity as a religion of Rome. He adapted Christianity to a new form which was implemented as the religion of Rome. Constantine's reign as emperor was actually related to the Syrian Sol Invictus cult of sun worship. Now, the man that's writing this is a Catholic. Actually related to the Syrian Sol Invictus cult of sun worship, but he determined to create a purpose-built religion to divert Christianity from its Judaic origins. He redefined Jesus' birthday to comply with the sun festival on the 25th of December and substituted the sacred Sabbath, Saturday, with the Sunday. Indeed, by a series of such maneuvers, the high points of Judaic Christianity were conveniently merged with the pagan tradition and the Persian cult of Mithras, which stressed the concept of final judgment, was also partially enveloped. The outcome from a purely political base was a uniquely contrived and controllable state hybrid of the Roman Church. On being formalized at the councils of Nicaea and Constantinople, the new Roman doctrine proclaimed all alternative faiths heretical, all except the Celtic Church, which was too well established to provoke. Any such attempt would have been tantamount to a declaration of war, particularly against Ireland. And at that time, Rome did not have the military capability to confront the fierce troops of the Irish kings. Fascinating stuff. But we're not dead. We're not done. Page 63. According to the Masonic tradition, the Knights of St. Andrew were the inheritors of an order established in 586 BC. Remember that date? 586, that was the year that Judah was overthrown. They were the temple guard of Jerusalem who were gathered by the high priest Hilkiah before the temple of Solomon was destroyed by King Nebuchadnezzar of Babylon. Their task at that time was to secrete the treasure from the invader and to carry away certain items of express significance. This was, of course, the very year when the sacred Stone of Destiny found its way to Ireland with the prophet Jeremiah. One more quote here. Page 69. It was Erhi, Ammon's son, Eochad, high king of Ireland, who married Tamar Tephi, the daughter of King Zedekiah of Judah, about 586 B.C. This is not a religious book, people. This is a historical book about lineage. With her father held a captive in Babylon and her brothers murdered by Nebuchadnezzar, Tamar had escaped to Ireland with the prophet Jeremiah, and with them came the Stone of Destiny. This almost makes the hair in the back of your neck stand up. As we have seen, this event coincided with the Jerusalem Temple Guard's instruction to remove sacred treasures from the grasp of the invading king of Babylon, and it is therefore apparent that Jeremiah was rather more than just a prophet. Indeed, as given in the Old Testament, he was the son of Hilkiah, the very Zadok high priest who created the order of the Temple Guard, the order which eventually became the Knights of St. Andrew. Hilkiah was also the high priest who first discovered the Mosaic Book of the Law hidden within the temple. From Tamar and Eochad were destined most of the royal lines of Ireland. This is amazing. Amazing stuff. It confirms what's here. Now, what an unbelievable story of deliverance and courage and a destiny that would not be denied. I'm going to turn to Luke 3. It's taking a lot for me to do this because I have trouble with some of these biblical names, but I want to read a little bit of the lineage here. That's recorded in Luke 3, and we'll begin in verse 23. Now, Jesus himself began his ministry at about 30 years of age, being, as was supposed, the son of Joseph, the son of Heli, the son of Mathat, the son of Levi, the son of Melchi, the son of Janna, the son of Joseph, the son of Mattathiah, the son of Amos, the son of Nahum, the son of Esli, the son of Nagai, the son of Maath, the son of Mathathiah, the son of Simei, the son of Joseph, the son of Judah, the son of Jonas, the son of Risa, the son of Zerubbabel, the son of Shealtiel, the son of Neri, the son of Melchi, the son of Adai, the son of Kosam, the son of El Modam, the son of the son of Josi, the son of Eliezer, the son of Jorim, the son of Mathat, the son of Levi, the son of Simeon, the son of Judah, the son of Joseph, the son of Jonan, the son of Eliakim, the son of Meliah, the son of Menan, the son of the son of Nathan, the son of David, the son of Jesse, the son of Obed, the son of Boaz, the son of Salmon, the son of Nashon, the son of Aminadab, the son of Ram, the son of Hezron, the son of Perez, the son of Judah. The son of Perez. Perez is part of the kingly line to Jesus Christ. Now, if you read the rest, it goes all the way back to Adam. That's how you know that what happened in the Garden of Eden, Genesis, was not a figurative story, which some will claim, because Jesus Christ claims his lineage all the way back to Adam. How can he be a descendant of a figurative character? That's ridiculous. But there's another important verse that I think is even more intriguing than the one that we just went over. And that's in Matthew, the book of Matthew, chapter 1. Matthew 1, verse 1. The book of the genealogy of Jesus Christ, the son of David, the son of Abraham, the son of Isaac. Isaac begot Jacob. Jacob begot Judah and his brothers. Judah begot Perez. And Zerah by Tamar. Perez begot Hezron. And Hezron begot Ram. Now, verse 3 is really interesting. You're doing a genealogy here. And it mentions both brothers. Where do you find that anywhere else? He mentions Perez and Zerah by Tamar. This is unusual. This is highly unusual to read a genealogy like that. In fact, I don't know of any other place that does that. Now, the descendants of Zerah, they play a really important part in perpetuating the kingly line. That's what this is about. But that history is so easily overlooked because a lot of these things are not connected together. And I want to connect it with something else that's very important. In Genesis 49, you might recall that's where many of the promises, well, the blessings are handed down to the sons of Jacob. But I want to focus on one in particular. That's verse 10. Genesis 49, verse 10. This helps to complete the story. The scepter shall not depart from Judah, nor a lawgiver from between his feet, until Shiloh comes, and to him shall be the obedience of the people. This is a prophecy. This is a blessing. I'm going to read from one of the commentaries here. Actually, I think this is a biblical dictionary regarding this. The scepter. It says, a staff borne by a ruler as the badge of his authority. Scepters are depicted on many bas-reliefs of Assyrian and Persian kings. Sometimes scepters were short like a mace, sometimes long and garnished with a royal insignia. We know that in some cases a scepter was a strong rod about the height of a man, which ancient kings and chiefs wore as an insignia of honor. It is believed to originate in the shepherd's staff, since the first kings were mostly nomad princes. Diodorus Siculus informs us that the scepter of the Egyptian kings bore the shape of a plow, of Osiris a flail and crook, whereas that of queens besides the crown was two loose feathers on the head. And this is important here, I think. The allusions to the scepter are metaphorical and describe it simply as one of the insignia of supreme power. The use of the staff as a symbol of authority was not confined to kings. Well, I don't think I need to read any more of that. The scepter promise in chapter 49 is a reference to the Messiah and the authority. It's never going to be taken away from Judah. That honor would never be taken from Judah. The Jews have suffered horribly with the loss of the kingdom. But this promise of the Messiah coming from Judah. It was never going to be taken away. Now, this strange account that we read at the beginning regarding Judah's sons, Onan, and Shelah, it begins to take on some significance that is easily overlooked. Now, it gives us some substance as to why God killed and later Onan, Judah's first two sons. They would not be allowed to have their name in the genealogy of the Messiah. They were not going to be included. Perhaps more importantly, through this goes back, 2,500 years or more? 2,700 years? We can see that God is faithful to His promises and that nothing can stand in the way of the destiny that He desires. This blessing to Judah occurred before he had any children at all. This blessing occurred before the birth of Perez and Zerah. They were born decades and decades and decades before what happened to King Zedekiah. Well, can God see the end from the beginning? Absolutely. He set up something to make His desired destiny come to pass. And I think we should take great comfort in reading a story like this and understanding it. Because God has given us His Spirit. That Spirit is a promise of eternal life. He's going to make it happen. He has called you. You've had the hands laid, you've repented, you've had hands laid on you, you received the Holy Spirit, you have that promise from God that you will be in the kingdom. Is God faithful to keep His promises? Well, you just saw this remarkable story here that we went through. Absolutely. Through impossible, it just seemingly impossible events, how could it ever happen after the king's sons were killed that David could continue to have a line that would end up with Christ sitting on the throne? I hope that you're thankful that God's will is going to be accomplished. Not only in everyone else, but in you. Now we're going to share in the glory of the kingdom because He has promised that to all of His saints. The praises to the Eternal for His wonderful faithfulness.